so long on NEI, we're not too aware of it. And from a certain point of view, it didn't too much concern them either, but it brought to light some important cultural differences between European models of musical editions and American models. And you'll all realize we don't publish a lot of musical editions in the US. And almost all of the Maison Pascal that we know in library collections are parked in music libraries in the US. And that may also be the case in many other places. But there are differences, I guess, of expectation. And what particularly concerned the US NEI community was that we had invested a lot of time and effort in the Music Encoding Initiative and all the technical details, but we hadn't ever thought too much about what happens to NEI data that is not in the first instance put online when it traverses traditional paths of publishing and distribution. And so this panel was inspired by that idea. It's not limited to the original discussion, but it does begin with a brief description of some of the issues and things that probably our music library community in the US failed to know about the relationship between, first of all, what is a critical edition, and then what is a digital critical edition. And we have a very well qualified panel. It really exceeded my expectations. And every single person is representing a different sort of institution and a different perspective. Some of the titles and job descriptions are not quite right, or they won't for too much longer be current. And I'm going to let people introduce themselves so that we're sure to hear correct job titles. But I'd just like to briefly introduce our six panelists. We start out with three people I've called providers for the purpose of this discussion, and three people who are, in a round sense, consumers because they have something to do with music libraries, and so they're the people trying to use the end results of our work. And we're really happy to have them all here today. In the order in which they will speak, they're Norbert Dubovy, Mauro Calcagno, Douglas Woodfill Harris, Daniel Boomhauer, Phil Panella, I think, can't remember the order, might be reversed there, and Federica Griba. And they will take us on a tour of issues and perspectives that come from the preparation of editions, from the publication of editions, and from issues of use when digital media of various sorts reach librarians and what some of the issues are that come up there. I don't want to take any more time. Each panelist has 10 minutes, and we will have a just stand up and stretch break after the third one, and then we will have 20 minutes reserved for your questions and your proposals about ways to go forward and other models that we might like to look at for critical editions in music. So, Norbert, I'm turning the chair over to you.
Yes. Thank you. As Anna just said, I want to introduce myself. I'm working for the Opera Project at the University of Frankfurt in Germany. And we just recently published our first volume of the critical hybrid edition series. Giambattista Casti's and Antonio Salieri's Prima Musica Poi il Barocco. This is the Corpus Delicti. And I would like to mention that my remarks here are not meant as an introduction into the opera project, but maybe a kind of a virtual and somehow polemic reply to the discussion that was mentioned earlier. We are living in an era of the digital image. Search engines let you search and retrieve images of any kind, often even without the context of the website they are embedded in. Individual libraries and large national and international digitizing projects provide huge and constantly growing amounts of digital images. Pictures seem to stand for themselves. We have become accustomed to consuming the images as they are. They come either with no or scarce information or with loads of bibliographical metadata, but rarely any explanation of their content. This is one of the outcomes of the digital culture we are living in. With the omnipresence and yet isolation of the picture, a product such as an opera hybrid edition can easily be misunderstood, since the simplest description of a hybrid edition is a combination of a traditional printed score, this one, and a set of digital source images provided on this little device. To the eye of the uninformed beholder, it looks like this. This is a CD, a music CD, audio CD, with a separate data CD carrying all the pictures of the score that was used in the production of this CD. This is a kind of bonus CD for those who want to satisfy their curiosity and see what a manuscript of the 18th century looks like. However, even if there are similarities, the digital images in a hybrid edition are no bonus track, not the kind of showcase set up in the foyer of a library to put the treasures of the library on display. You know, and we know, that the point of the hybrid edition is not the digital image, even though it is a very important part, but it is all the analytical brainwork, the application of certain criteria of textual criticism that lie between the printed volume and the raw digital images. The essence is not the mere listing of variant readings, there's an apparatus of variant readings provided in this device, but it is the structuring and linking that is done by the editor in preparing the edition, the mapping of each single bar or verse of the text against the relative verse of a text line in another source, the finding of the common denominator, ultimately with the goal of making sense of what we find in the material we retrieve, all of which is then presented again in a tool which is called Edirom. This is contained on this credit card shaped data storage device. It is here in the intangible space between the printed score and the raw source pictures where the actual edition is located. In other words, the whole set, the printed score plus the edition, is the edition. This explains why our interest is to have edition accessible to users and not sitting forgotten in a drawer behind the librarian's desk. The opera hybrid editions respond to certain developments in textual criticism and the editing of music, and we try to give an answer through the use of this electronic platform, and we are doing this through the medium of the hybrid edition. One of the challenges in doing this and in publishing or editing Prima La Musica was the modification and restructuring of the Edirom software, which was originally developed for instrumental music. This must that needed to be restructured, because one of the cornerstones of our edition project is the belief that the text edition and textual sources are as important as musical sources. There was a time when people believed the text and the score is all we need, and the librettis, the sources related to the text, are secondary. But this is very important, and they need to have a place, and this is the idiom. I would like to thank on this occasion the team, the Edirum team in Detmold and Paderborn, for the support and for reshaping the software. It was not the Opera project who did it, but our friends and colleagues from the Edirum project. In addition, the Opera project, such as Prima la Musica, is not meant to be the one and only, the ultimate edition of the work. This was an edition that responds to a specific set of issues identified at the beginning of the editing process. Issues that may be related to its place in history, the genre, the sources, or the media that I used. In the case of Prima la Musica, which is a meta-melodrama, it was a pre-existing music. The question was how to adequately treat the relationship between Salieri's newly composed music and the pre-existing pieces that are worked into the score. I give you an example. Here's one page from Salieri's autograph score, and when you turn the page or the next page, there's a blank page, and it says on the top, what is missing can be found in the court or theater archive. So it just relates to another source, to another manuscript. It does not continue writing. Only a few pages later he picks up. And here you see the idiom showing those sources, the other sources that may be found in the theater or court archive that had to be fit in this space. And going back, I said it responds to certain questions. Opera is not just an editorial project, it is also a research project, as it tries to find a way to answer certain questions for each individual work, 21 pieces total, of different areas and different geographic regions, different genres. As I said, in the case of Salieri, the problem is the meta-melodrama, the use of pre-existing music, though it is placed in a module, as we call it, musical and textual parody. It's the first work here on the list. And there are other criteria that can be grouped, and works can be associated with those criteria or issues. I mentioned the last one, beyond opera, that is the inclusion of certain media such as film, as in the Eric Satie's Relâche and Bernd Alois Zimmermann's Musik für das Supergebirge. One brief word on the opera project in general. The project is housed at the University of Frankfurt now, and it is funded by the Union of the German Academies of Sciences and Humanities, managed by the Academy of Sciences and Literature in Mainz. Everybody in this room, I think, is experienced enough to know that starting and running a project like opera requires a certain application process that includes not only the formulation of the scientific goals, but a thorough projection of time and costs. The program is funded through two main channels, but in the end, it is 100% Goethe German taxpayer money, a six-digit euro amount per year. It is also important to understand that opera is not a Bärenreiter project, as some people stated. Our partner, Bärenreiter, is responsible for the production and distribution, and they may have their own costs, and they do have their own costs in editing and producing the volumes, but they are not responsible for the contents. Thus, the sales price, by some critics deemed high, does not include any costs for the development of the contents of the edition. Our first volume costs about the same as a comparable publication without digital support, either from Bärenreiter or AR Editions or other publishing houses. If you would work the real costs of a research program into the price, Primala Musica would top even Ricordis Meyerbeer edition. I think the price was somewhere 3,500 euros. Among the costs of running the program, one has to distinguish between labor costs, which are overall quite predictable, and non-personal costs or material costs. The latter include a certain amount set aside for digitization and publication rights, stipulated in the original grant application, in the grant. Despite the generosity of the taxpayer, funds are not unlimited, and in some cases, the retrieval of materials, in other cases the expenditure for its use, is where things get murky. Primala Musica is not the best example for showing the challenges of digitization, but this is because in Primala Musica we have very generous support from the Austrian National Library, and they waived the fee for publication since the number of copies that is produced is very low, and so did the Conservatory of Pesaro, who has holds another score. In other cases, it's much more difficult. In Paris, we had to send students with a camera who took the photos, and even though the library allowed taking the photos, we still have to negotiate the fees for the publication. A cold shower came last week, and I'm sorry to have to tell this in the presence of my dear friend Federica Riva from Florence Conservatory. We had asked an estimate of cost for a Paella score, and we were told that a picture would cost 1 euro plus tax, 22% tax, and when I ordered the score, we were told that the price has gone up from 1 euro to 2 euros, so it doubled the price, and it is inconceivable why a score by Paella would then cost in the end 2,000 euros, while let's say a Spontini score from Northwestern University costs only $200. So we have to distinguish between costs for the digitization, fees for publication, and costs for potentially putting this online, because this is one of the requests that we heard, why is this stuff not online? You can imagine the grant, the project was approved in a certain way, and you cannot change halfway, now we do it differently, even though it will cost thousands of euros more. I would just say one remark about the hybrid edition, because there are questions, why do we do this hybrid? And there are many, many good reasons. But I want to mention only one thing. I have recently thought a lot about what I heard from my colleagues when I taught at the University of Cincinnati. Confronted with the questions, what edition are you playing from? Students may answer, the one my teacher gave me. This is a sign of a certain attitude. With not a whole lot of reflection, editions seem to drop out of nowhere. They're just there, and somebody said, take this one. And among the advantages of the hybrid edition, this edition for example, is that the musical or literary text can be shown that the text has a material basis, because all the sources are shown in the idiom and the relationship between the sources, as I tried to show before. And this is, as I remember, and what I would like to remind you, what we are trying to do, to teach our students and whoever is interested in this kind of music, we try to teach them a deeper understanding for the historical conditionality of the music, and for that matter, any output of human creativity. Thank you.
foundation for the rest of our discussion. And I want to offer a retort. I asked our music librarian at Stanford, Jerry McBride, what the most usual criterion was that a student might use selecting an edition in the music library, and he said the one nearest to the door. And if you've been involved with creating critical editions for a long time, this is very disheartening, but I suppose there's something in North American classrooms that just isn't happening. Students have that idea. Although if it's for their next exam, they just want to grab it off the shelf and they're going to return it tomorrow, so in some contexts it probably doesn't matter too much. Anyway, we're going to move right along here. Our next presenter is Mallaro Calcagno, and he's going to talk to us about another, and for now, all digital edition, Marenzio Online.
So I'm Mallaro Calcagno from the University of Pennsylvania, and I co-direct the Marenzio Online Digital Edition with Laurent Pugin, and other scholars such as Giuseppe Giampino mentioned that. And thank you, Perry, for all this, and thank you very much for inviting us to participate in this roundtable. And in the post on the MLI list that originated this roundtable, Darren Scott expressed the by now common view that, quote, putting critical commentary in some sort of digital form makes sense as an alternative form of access, end quote. This view echoes, although only in part, a reaction that is now common also in some musicological quarters, a reaction to those book-length critical commentaries that are familiar to us from complete works editions, such as the Neubach Ausgabe or the works of Giuseppe Verdi, among many, which are deemed to be not user-friendly. Ivan Skaper yesterday in the workshop of Edron mentioned that that is how Edron started. He went to his professor at the university, and the issue was exactly how to manage the issue of the paper at the apparatus and do something different. One recurrent argument is that performers, and certainly one of the main users of our libraries, or non-users, do not have the time or inclination to look within the scriptural reports at the description of sources, at the list of variants, and at the editor's explanations for his or her her decisions, especially now that they can download, you know, PDFs from the Petrucci Library on the web. As Roger Parker writes in a 2009 Opera Quarterly article lamenting his own experience as of writing the critical report of Nabucco, published in 1983, I quote, "A substantial number of entries of my report were hardly of pressing interest to performers or other users of the score," end quote. And Parker continues, quote, "The only possible audience for many of these hundreds of notes in my critical report was the small handful of Verdi scholars interested in the minutiae of the composer's compositional habits. But these people," Parker continues, "would of course insist on consulting the original documents. Who would dare formulate ideas about such topics from secondary sources?" End quote. Parker says that he realized that no one would have read most of his enormous critical commentary. In an article in last year's spring issue of the Journal of the American Musicological Society, or JAMS, as we say here in the States, Philip Gossett counteracts Parker's view, and I quote from him also because I like to emphasize for our roundtable, as we have done so far, the role of performers as users of libraries. Gossett writes that a conductor once called him from Europe during a recording session, having compared a faint fermata that he noticed in the facsimile of an autograph of a Rossini overture with the same passage in two critical editions. The conductor noted that one edition had a fermata, the other one didn't. Gossett referred him to the proper critical note of the latter edition, of course his own edition, which specified that the fermata belonged to a rejected version. However, I quote, "no one," Gossett continues, "expects a musician or even a scholar to read the critical commentary from beginning to end. That is not its purpose. A commentary," Gossett concludes, "is meant to assist those who use an edition or to help them understand what underlies it. it is clear that everyone will look to such notes for different kinds of information, end quote. So transferring the critical apparatus from paper to digital format has the advantage of bypassing juxtapositions like those between Parker and Gosset that I just mentioned. Especially, I would say, if the user can interact really easily with the critical notes, I think both Performance and Scholar. Note that both Gosset and Parker think that opera is a fluid object, but no one mentions digital editions as the solution. They are just disputing about paper editions. That doesn't even mention in a footnote the possibility that we all now have instead of having opera in a digital edition. So in several aspects, creating a paper-based music edition or creating a digital musical edition is a similar editorial process. The starting point is the selection of the primary sources to which access must be organized. The sources are transcribed and compared, and the critical apparatus is built upon editorial criteria that must be defined. Finally, the critical edition can be published together with its additional material, including introductory text and comments. Now, this that I just summarized is obviously an extremely shortened overview of a complex process. But the point is that both paper-based and digital editions have deep similarities. And it is not impossible for a project initially intended to produce a paper-based edition to be retargeted to produce a digital edition or both. This is indeed how the Marenzio Online Digital Edition developed. It started about 10 years ago as an innovative enterprise, mainly because the detection of the variants was planned to be done through the software mentioned earlier, Aruspix, a software application created by Laurent Pogen for the optical recognition, the superimposition, and the collation of early music prints, a tool meant to facilitate and speed up the work of the editor. But the output of the edition was initially meant to be on paper. We shifted gradually to the digital format represented by the prototype, which I'll show later, for a variety of reasons. I mentioned only two. One was that we didn't have the funds to pay a publisher like Polschke, for example, in Italy. And the second was that even if we had a publisher that would do this for free, the publisher would impose some editorial guidelines about layout, and we wanted to be free of that. So in the end, the main difference between paper and digital edition is the tool used for creating and publishing the final. Changing the publishing option or choosing to have multiple publishing options can be possible even fairly late in the process. It does not radically change the philological principles. However, and this is of the essence, particularly here, all options remain feasible, or at least easily executable, only if the option that explicitly includes the logical structure of the edition is available, that is, the digital edition as envisaged by MEI. This interchangeability means that the choice of digital edition does not preclude the printing of a paper-based edition at some point in the process. Quite the contrary, it can be a valuable path, since a digital edition can act as a reservoir where the editions in preparation can be accumulated before moving to the printing step that would occur only when the project has reached an acceptable level of development. In fact, we do assume that eventually the Marenzio Online Edition has this kind of output. Indeed, we need to wonder if by creating an exclusive digital environment where the edition can be corrected or updated at any time, we're not preparing a hyper-stop press correction problem for the readers of the next generation. A hybrid approach in which the paper edition does have a role can be useful in this respect. This hybrid, or better, sort of staggered approach can also be beneficial when the sources involved in the preparation of the editions are remarkably problematic, for example, in the cases of manuscripts with dubious attributions. The edition can be prepared and still made available digitally with the option to correct it whenever necessary before printing the entire series at the moment in which its level of completeness is indeed satisfactory. Let me just move on because I don't want to go over the terminals. As we know from the fantastic work that Ediron is doing or from the online Chopin Variorum edition, the rendering of 19th century music notation outside the music notation software application is a challenge because of the complexity of the music rotation of the time. The situation of 16th and 17th century music is different, and some developments achieved over the last decade have made it possible to explore new horizons that could not be envisaged 10 or 20 years ago. On the one hand, dedicated tools designed for transcribing sources and for creating music editions of the late Renaissance and early Baroque music have reached a high level of development. In particular, the Aruspic project, as mentioned, and the Gamera project have made it possible to perform optical music recognition on typographic prints, which made it conceivable to obtain a transcription of the original sources of the repertoire in a digital form very quickly. On the other hand, we must acknowledge that the music notation of this early repertoire is not too complicated and certainly significantly less challenging to represent than 19th century piano notation. The Madrigal score is undoubtedly simpler than the Prelude of Chopin, regardless of the editorial problems each of them might arise. Having tools to transcribe sources in a digital form and at the same time a notation with a complexity that makes it realistic to represent it in a digital environment outside the music rotation software application put the repertoire of the 16th and 17th century in a privileged situation in the development of digital edition. In the Marenzo Online Digital Edition, we set up a prototype that illustrates how music, critical material, and images as encoded in a May Digital Edition can be presented together in an interactive and intuitive way. An innovative aspect of the prototype is that the music is rendered natively in the web browser using the scalable vector graphics SVG format, a standard particularly well suited to user interaction. With such an approach, no software or plugin needs to be installed for the visualization of the edition, which drastically reduces the problems related to software distribution and to web browser compatibilities. In the prototype, the user can turn the pages like a book, but also zoom in or out with a very high display quality. When it is relevant for the user, facsimile images are also included, but these are chosen by the editor, but not all there, and the critical apparatus can be displayed below the music page. It's a pop window. The critical notes, which follow standard philological practice, are very easy to read and follow because they are displayed together with the music. While the prototype still operates at an experimental level, it nonetheless shows the potential of having on the one hand a tool that is platform and web browser independent, and on the other hand data in standardized and open format. The prototype also incarnates a digital music edition environment solution that is not limited to the repertoire, even though it is true, as I said, that the reduced complexity of the scope of the variants make it a reasonable starting point. There are also very few variants for Marenzo. Einstein said it's an Einfach edition. So oh. The notation of the madrigal of Marenzo put into score is almost indistinguishable from common Western music notation, with the exception of very few idiomatic components of the repertoire, such as, you know, coloration or proportion size, they might still appear. There is thus no reason such an approach could not be developed further for music of later repertoires, including the 17th century or even beyond. In the future, such digital editions would offer a wide range of advantages over paper-based printed editions, such as, it was mentioned this morning, accessibility, updatability for both corrections and augmentation, and readability. But such editions will also offer new possibilities, as the digital music representation of the data will de facto be made available for further processing. For example, it will be possible with the development of new algorithms to make the musical content of a digital edition searchable, which is not possible with a PDF online edition. Searching musical content is a field of research itself, as we know, that requires digital data on which to operate, and it will directly benefit from the development of digital editions. Thank you very much.
Originally intended to
the speakers, first of all, if they have questions for each other, and just one or two questions from the audience, just directed to these two speakers that we've heard so far before we move on. So does anybody involved in the round table want to say anything? And does anybody in the audience want to ask any factual questions? If not, I think we will move on to Bill Planella's presentation. I've been reluctant to allow very much time to introduce the speakers, but he comes to us from the Indiana University Library. And for those of you, many of you who come from other countries, I should say Indiana University School of Music is the largest school of music in the U.S. And it is a school that, last time I was there, had a lot of music education majors and a lot of student performers, although it certainly has musicology and many other things. Thank you.
Sure, thank you. Thank you all for having me today, and I want to thank especially Eleanor and the Rocco from our Center for the History of Music Theory and Literature, which has its home in Bloomington, who I think is the person who made the connection with that. Now, I have 14 slides in 10 minutes, so you can all do the math. So, here we go. Clicker. Eleanor has already indicated that we have a very large school, and I just want to give you the context so you know where I'm coming from. I think my other colleagues who will come after me will come from a different perspective, so I want to make sure you understand where I'm coming from. We have a very large school, 1,600 music students, and it's more than music education. We actually have a very fine musicology department, which was cited not long ago as one of the finest in the country, and we generally have about 40 to 50 majors in residence getting master's and doctorates in musicology. So it's quite a large department, and as my colleague Keith Cochran, who's our collection development librarian, wants to talk about, our collection represents the school, and it is broad and deep. We offer degrees most to the doctoral programs, to the doctoral level, and we do it in just about every possible discipline in music that you might want to go to school for. So we have a lot of stuff, and we have to collect it at a very high level. So consequently, we have one of the largest music libraries in the United States. I used to work at the other one at Eastman. When I was there, I said that was the largest, and now I say ours is the largest. That's not accomplished. But we're also, that 1,600 students and 200 faculty are spread over several buildings, which adds to the complexity of this issue that we're here to discuss today. In our music library, we have approximately 120 computers for people to use, Macs and PCs. Here you see three different locations, actually. You see the kind of computers we have. But what this means is that students are engaged at these workstations doing many things, and the notion of going to a place to find a copy of a particular piece of software is a little unsettling for them. These computers, as I said, are throughout the library, and they do everything from Microsoft Word to typing an email to your mom to doing required listening to our digital music library system that we've developed to anything else you might imagine. So that's a very important part of this equation. So when I was asked to participate, I was given the question to answer, what happened when this edition arrived in our library, and what did we do with it? So what happened was, I wasn't in my office, and our head of cataloging left it on my desk with a note that said, see the thing in the back, what do you want to do? And there, that's my desk, and it's still sitting there months later, because first I didn't know what to do, and then I knew I was coming here, so I thought I'd hang on to it. And I have to be honest, and I think this is a cultural thing, that thing in the back, it took me, I should introduce myself, in addition to being director of the Cook Music Library, I'm also director of information technology for the Jacobs School. So I get technology, and I like technology, but it took me about 10 to 15 minutes to figure out what the thing was. I was pulling on the end for a long time, trying to pull it out, and then even better, in my bag back there, I still have, I have three kids, so we have a bunch of different cameras over the years, and I got one of those multi-card reader devices that has USB. So I said, oh, well, surely I've got the right card reader for this. And so I was trying to figure out how I got that. It was a mess. Okay, so that's what happened. There's like, what do we do with this? So, and it remains in that state. We also have in our library a copyright librarian who sits in the office next to me. He's a lawyer who's really fantastic. And I said, hey, what can we do with this? And so he quickly pointed me to this license agreement that states very clearly, simultaneous parallel utilization by libraries via an in-house network is permitted, provided that no more than two simultaneous utilizations are involved. So, while we do have a fairly robust technology infrastructure, and I am, after all, the director of IT, and I suppose I could have directed someone to make that happen. It's complicated, and we don't like to do these one-off things. We don't like to be able to say, well, for that thing, we have this scenario, and for that thing, you have this scenario. We like to make it fit into the overall infrastructure. So we got stuck as to what to do. So let me tell you a little bit about what the two options were that came to mind immediately, what we would have liked to have done, and two that came to mind that we didn't like, and then one that we think would be better. So the two options are not desirable. We can install it on a single computer at the reference desk, like the RISM A1 CD-ROM that Baron Ryder, no offense, sent to us a few years ago that we weren't all that happy with either. It sits on that computer where the arrow points. That is our reference desk, and there's someone working there. If you want to use that CD-ROM, you go to that computer. And this feels very much like 1994. Right? Remember, we got worked in libraries in the 90s. That's what we did, right? You had a CD-ROM computer, and you went to that computer to do your search. And when the new CD-ROM came next month, you went and you did your search again, right, to see what changed. So we didn't like that option very much. The other option is, we could leave it in the back, but we would lose it then. So what we would more likely do is make a copy of it, burn it to a CD, stick the CD in the back of the book, and shove it on the shelf, and we never think about it again. And if that thing got stolen, then, we burn another copy at some point, because we surely put the little card in the vault somewhere that 10 years from now someone would say, what is this? And spend 15 minutes trying to figure out what to do with it. What we prefer, and this is in general, we prefer online access, right? And we prefer it authenticated by IP range, so that any computer in our range of computers can access it at any time, anywhere, and what we'd like to do is link it from our online catalog. This is sort of our modus operandi when it comes to these types of issues. The thing gets cataloged, it's in our database, that's the database for everything, and if there's some kind of supplemental material, you click the link in that record and you get to it if you have the proper authorization. And that's on our end to figure out. It's a bad image, but this is a student workstation in the music library, and it gives you a sense as to what's going on. This person's editing audio, they're writing a paper, they're doing other stuff on the computer. This is how they work today. And I'm sorry to say that I fear that if it doesn't have this kind of online representation, it becomes irrelevant. And I should also take a moment to be sure that you understand, I think that the opera publication is fantastic. I think it represents great scholarship, and I think the hybrid edition is exactly the right thing that we need. It's way better than the traditional monuments that we collect, where the students don't like to deal with the critical commentary, mostly because American students don't like to read foreign languages, and even the musicologists, who shouldn't be reading German fluently, are really hesitant to do it. Our performers are less like Stanford. I do have a good picture I was trying to find on my phone. We have students in the stacks pulling out the same edition of many works, comparing them, which I'm really encouraged by. But the Kritische Bericht, they don't want to deal with those as it's in German. Why would I want to find a German speaker and help? They won't do it. So this way to bring it to them really presents an opportunity. And why do I say that? We did a survey a couple years ago. This is a few years out of date. Just some relevant questions to this discussion. How often do you use electronic resources for research in the field of music, like the New Grove, Rillum, JSTOR? You see our responses. We got about 220 people responded, which, is okay. Very frequently or frequently. The students are using these, right? We know that they're using electronic resources. They prefer electronic first. And for better or for worse, that's the world in which we live. And it's hard for me, when I have to teach music bibliography and explain to them that sometimes you might have to go to the shelf and actually pull the thing off the shelf. It's okay. And they're a little nervous about that. The Cook Music Library should actively digitize scores and parts for use. Most of them agree. Everybody likes this idea. They really want to have it online. This is not a question. I'm not telling you anything you didn't already know about. But in my research, I typically use both. This is where it starts to get interesting. Right? They want to have both. They love the digital because they want to be able to be sitting at home on their laptop. They want to be wherever they are and be able to access the thing. But when it comes to using it for performance, especially, of course, they want to have the printed thing. And to what extent do you use online things like IMSLP, the Petrucci Library? We know they're doing this a lot. They really like this. But the other question that I thought was really telling was, do you think digital scores will replace print scores in the next, when most of them, are leaning towards never? And I don't know that I put this on here. No, I didn't. The other question that I should have added here was, if you have a digital score, what will you do with it? Play from a digital edition off of an iPad or something like that? It was like 90%, I'm going to print it out. So this is a big dilemma, right? So the hybrid edition really represents the best of both worlds, which I think is what our students are asking for. So and why do I say it's even further? This is a screenshot from the Variations program. I would imagine this audience has heard about the Variations Digital Music Library. It was developed at IU in the 90s, and we continue to use it today. We stream a whole lot of audio this way. So why do I think this kind of authenticated access online is the way to go? Well, it encourages use and reuse. So this is one of the tools that's in there, and so this is an audio, rather than just playing that audio, students can interact with that audio. They can do this bubble diagram that those of you who took music theory are probably familiar with. They can annotate that audio, and similarly, they can do the same thing with scores. They have the opportunity to work with these materials. But more importantly, the second bullet is that it protects copyright. I know there's a great fear that license agreement, you know, points to this, we want it on one or two, because we know libraries are the great sucking place of all the users. You buy it once and you make it available to millions of people. And that is an issue, and I agree. However, here's the corollary. We can buy a CD, and we digitize it, put it in our system, and it gets used a lot. If we don't digitize it, we haven't digitized everything, we see this phenomenon where students come to the circulation desk, and they check out, you know, a stack of 10 CDs, they walk off into the reference area with their laptop, and they come back 20 minutes later and turn them in and check out another 10. And we know what they're doing, right? We have to protect against that. If we stick the CD in the back of the volume, you know, on MTube, whatever this will be, O or whatever, we're just giving them copies of it, because all they're going to do is walk through the reference area, open up that thing, stick the CD in their laptop, as I did when I got it. I put it in my laptop and said, let me see what this thing does. And I haven't deleted it, so I guess I have an illegal copy of my laptop sitting back there, right? Well, I bought one. I own one. So this is really the difference. That kind of access, in my opinion, was that? Don't arrest me. I'm leaving right after this meeting. You can't block the session. So I think that the digital means of today present a way to protect the publisher and the intellectual property rights owners in a way that sticking the media in the back and letting somebody download it, you know, that opens up a whole ball of crazy options for the students. And more importantly, like the CDs, and I'm probably worse about time, right? Like the CD-ROMs that came out in the 90s, the Voyager products, remember those? We still have some of those. And they're completely useless now, right? When I first got to Indiana in 2004, we still had this old Mac that was sitting in the corner, and it wasn't on the network because it was so old. The security people said, you can't have that operating system anymore. And I said, well, you know, it's the only one that will play those three CDs. So, you know, what have we done? I think we got rid of it. We just said, put it in a book sale and get rid of it, because it's irrelevant. And this kind of access provides the opportunity to keep these things viable, because the technology, you know, that USB thing, who knows if that's going to even be usable in a few years. So if you have it in your control, and we're willing to pay a reasonable fee. I mean, we pay a lot. We actually bought the Buyer Edition, and they'll buy the next one. So, I mean, you can keep sending us those little things in the back. We're probably going to buy it, because we have musicologists who demand that we have it. So we will do it, but I can't promise that our resources are going to be inextinguishable over the next 20 years either. And there might come a time where we have to make hard choices. But, you know, this gives the content owner the opportunity to keep it alive and keep it fresh so that it can be used and exposes it to greater audiences. So those are my comments today. I guess I did it within 10 minutes. That was pretty good.
And we do respond to different constituencies, and one of our purposes today is to bring some of these issues out into the open and invite constructive discussion of ways to improve the situation so we feel again like we're all working towards the same objectives. That was a wonderful presentation, Phil. Indiana University has been sort of at the limits of digital technology for a long, long time. They had these three variations projects, and they had a very ambitious idea once when they were, I think, building a new music library back in the 90s, to put in all these workstations for digital audio when there was no iTunes, and it all meant having servers from here to Kingdom Come, because audio files are very, very big, and then delivering the files to multiple students at the same time so that the computer could still function. In other words, processing time was a lot slower than it is now, and there were many, many issues. And I have been there a couple times, though not recently, so I've seen some of these workstations. And I know even for us with MuseData, they posed some really difficult challenges back in the 90s because they wanted to use our data, which is also encoded classical scores. And they said, but we want to load them on a network. And that was a terrifying prospect we had never thought about before, because if it were a small place with a few students, as many music departments are in the U.S., it wouldn't mean much of anything. But when you know there are hundreds and hundreds, and in fact well over 1,000 students, and they all have access at one time or the other, then you want to know what the safeguards are, and then you get involved in a very technical conversation that changes every 5 minutes. The answers change every 5 minutes. So that really brought in a whole set of different perspectives, and I'm grateful for those. We should move along now to Dan Boomhauer, and he comes to us from the Library of Congress. He is a musicologist, but he is currently the head of Reader Services in the Music Division.
Thank you, Eleanor. It's an honor to be here and to be on this very distinguished panel. I don't have an argument, and I don't have PowerPoints. I do hopefully have some useful observations, though, that build on the comments that Phil made and relate to observations that Norbert was making about what institutions that hold primary source documents are faced with when dealing with commercial uses of their holdings. So let me give you a little more context about what I do. I'm the head of Reader Services in the Music Division of the Library of Congress. I oversee the reference staff and the Performing Arts Reading Room, and the management of our collection in the Music Division, which numbers over 20 million items. And in this role, I also am kind of influential in determining our priorities for the Music Division's digitization efforts. And I also, that's not about me. So the Library of Congress, I like to say, is just a big version of any other music library, in that we deal with the same issues that any other music library deals with. And so what Phil is describing, what do you do with this opera edition that lands on our desk? There's no way that we're going to host even what Phil did with the RISM A1 data CD-ROMs. We got those CD-ROMs. We're not going to do anything with them because the network configurations at the library defy comprehension. And I'll give our ITS and whatever technology services folks a break by observing that we also, the Library of Congress includes the library, the Copyright Office, and the Congressional Research Service. The Copyright Office holds sensitive data. The Congressional Research Service holds classified data on its networks. One would think that they're not all linked together, but you know, hackers may have good ideas about how they might be. So what we're able to do on client PCs is pretty limited. Those things are locked down. So the idea of hosting locally a single version of a unique application, like the Edirom, is inconceivable. Now, there are other things that we haven't got to that we should, and this is how we are kind of, we consume and produce a lot of content. And another sort of network scenario that we're contending with is how do we make available in our own reading room pretty simple data formats like TIFF and JPEGs of material that we've digitized that's still protected by copyright or is protected by agreements we've made with collection donors. So we have the archives of the Alvin Ailey Dance Theater, and we digitized a lot of materials from the Alvin Ailey Company, and that was sort of a condition of their gift of the collection to the library, that we digitize materials. But we haven't, it's really, so they're digitized, but they're not really available to researchers because we're not going to load these on a computer, a local computer that's off the network or something like that, and have that standing alone off of the network because it's not going to be supported by, you know, these push upgrades and things like that. So we also have, in an agreement with the Glinka Museum in Russia, we digitized all of our Rachmaninoff manuscripts, and they digitized all of their Rachmaninoff manuscripts and switched. And the materials, the Rachmaninoff materials that the Library of Congress holds, all post-date his immigration to the United States in 1918, so in general they're protected by copyright. And there again, what do? We have this great content, and there's no way to really easily access it in the reading room. So we have to figure out workarounds like staff PCs where a reader can sit down and interact with this content if they want. I mentioned that because it's like, so we've got these things that are relatively easy. We have Opera or Resume One, which are not as easy as image files to deal with. And then a third sort of stream of content that we're going to be dealing with very soon is copyright registrations that are submitted electronically. And it may have happened already or will happen soon, but the Copyright Office will release new best edition standards. And so if you are the producer of content that you wish to copyright, then you currently, or until recently, had to submit, if it was notated music, you had to submit a printed version of that music to the Copyright Office along with your registration, which is rather antiquated. Now or soon, you will be able to submit with your online registration a electronic file. And the best edition statement is just an outlining of what those different file formats we prefer would be. But the library knows how to ingest a lot of data, and we manage data fairly well. But there's always then the issue of delivering data, given the kind of network environment that I just described. So hopefully we'll be receiving notated music in electronic form. As most of you can probably guess, commercial publishers, if they're going to register their works using electronic submissions, it's going to be a PDF file, which maybe flies in the face of all of our hopes that are being expressed here. But that's how music is, and historically, since the scribes were working in scriptoria, it's a visual medium. It's an image file, and so we wholly expect that we're going to get a bunch of image files. Essentially, we do state as our primary purpose marked up, compliant, DTD based encoded music. So music XML or even better MEI. But we know that's not what we're going to get. And so we're going to have this big, huge stream of other stuff that we're going to have to figure out how to deliver into a reading room. So, which is to say nothing of a more broadly available environment. The whole point of copyright is to ensure that not a lot of copies get distributed without your knowledge. So the Library of Congress is not going to be putting online outside of its reading rooms content that's been registered for copyright. So it's in this context that we have to contend, an institution like the Library of Congress has to contend with these one-off products like Resume One or Opera or who knows what the next thing is going to be. And in that sense, there again, we go back to the fact that ultimately the Library of Congress is just a big version of what any other academic or research library is. It's, you know, we're kind of bound by network security and copyright protection. The one thing that, on the flip side, a way that we're more of a content producer is in our digitization efforts. And we have a couple hundred thousand objects that have been digitized. I don't know the exact number of pieces of music. And we continue to digitize on a regular basis. Depending on what the push is at any given time, it's, you know, a few hundred items to a few thousand items a year. So hopefully by the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War I, we will have online about 17,000 pieces of World War I related sheet music that have been recently digitized. But that's sort of outside of the norm. Tens of thousands of items get digitized in batches, but more often it's a few hundred or a thousand items per year. And this we make freely available for use on our website. There are very infrequently occasions where we request permissions from copyright holders to put it, to make something available on our website for non-commercial uses. And then if you wanted to do something with that material, you would have to go get your own permission or copyright clearance. But the 99% of the material we have available on our website is in the public domain and is available for you to use in any way you'd like. But there are these instances where if there are commercial uses, if you have intend to do something commercially with content that's available to an institution like the Library of Congress or any other library, the question is, well, are you doing that in good faith? So we've been spending lots and lots of taxpayer dollars to create this enormous collection of really important material. And while people can, you know, commercial entities can go and clear cut national forests, that doesn't sit well. And maybe the idea of harvesting all of this freely available content from the Library of Congress for your personal benefit may also not sit well. And if you're a producer of commercial content in an academic or artistic work environment, like the music community, how are you contributing as a commercial provider of content to the furtherance of the goals of that community? And I think the question then is, we've had a lot of success recently working with publishers who want to do facsimile editions of content, manuscripts in the Library of Congress collection, and finding a way that we can say, okay, here's what you want, you get that. What are you going to do for us? And there are ways that can be the sort of paying for the commercial provider is very limited. The one agreement that we currently have that's working very well, they produce facsimiles of our editions, it's a European publisher, and they, instead of paying us like a royalty or something like that, they just send us free copies of all of their other publications in that year, which for them is pretty low threshold. Publishers print a print run, and an extra copy of each title is not that expensive for them, and it's a lot easier for us to receive kind of gifts in kind than money anyways. There's another instance that I'll mention very vaguely. We were approached by a group that's working on a new critical edition of composers' works, for which the Library of Congress holds almost all of the primary sources, And they said, we want to send a graduate student to start getting digital images of all of these manuscripts. And I said, you know, we went to a colleague of mine, and he said, well, I'll send it to the reading room and see what, how that'll work out. And my response was, well, let's look at the materials first and see what that really will mean. Well, this is material that's on less than ideal quality paper. And while the notes written on the page are amazing, the paper itself stinks. And so the idea of someone coming into the reading room and kind of setting up with whatever kind of equipment to produce digital images of these manuscripts that are tightly bound as well. So the composer, very proud of his music, had them all bound in these lovely red leather bindings, but the gutters are very narrow. So to open it up, you're almost guaranteed to do damage to the manuscript. So the graduate student idea was right up. But I said to him, so we're going to have to digitize this stuff for you. And I believe, you know what, I think it was Margaret was saying, you know, 1 or 2 euros per page. Well, for some reason, the Library of Congress charges more like $40 or $50 per page. I really don't understand why this is, but it's not the music division that does this. And so, and that's generally why we try and work directly with publishers in the first place, is because they're going to have to go through us anyways, because they'll be scared off immediately by the prices for digital images through our reproduction services. So I said to the editor-in-chief of this edition, we're going to have to do it. It's going to cost us, in terms of labor, a lot of money to do this. Not that we're going to actually pay off money, but we're paying for the staff. So how can we make this work? And the notion was, well, these are all materials that are still protected by copyright. And we have good relationships with these copyright holders, but we're not in a position to make the case that you are, that having these primary sources available online is actually going to improve the value of the edition that you want to produce. You can't perform from these manuscripts, and there are no parts, so really you're not going to impact your market for the edition by having the sources online. So what we would like for you to do is to go to the rights holders, who they also have obviously a good relationship with, and make the case for us. Tell them why the sources, the primary sources, should be online, and for them, you kind of clear the permissions, the copyright clearances for us, and then we're in a position, we get something that we want, which is to start getting out these primary sources from the 20th century that are so rich and valuable, and you guys get the digital images that you need for your edition and for your editors. So those are the kinds of, like, as we move into these hybrid editions, there are a whole lot of issues that I just outlined. And like I said at the beginning, I have no answers, but I think the panel that Eleanor put together and all of you will make for a very good discussion that I look forward to. Thank you.
I never think of the music division of LC and the copyright office as necessarily being on the same wavelength. I have to tell you that we filed encoded music and got copyright registrations in 1987. And I can tell you a lot more about that in private. But they were perplexed, but I have to say what I admired was that they didn't just say no at the outset. They figured this is something we don't understand. But, you know, I showed it to them on paper. I attempted to explain it. We'll take up the rest privately. Because I would like to have our last participant give her exposition, let's say. So Federica, can you come on up? Federica Riva is a very distinguished music librarian in Philly. She's been very active in the International Association. university libraries in the U.S. to talk to each other, but then we have to get back into the wider world and realize that libraries come in a lot of shapes and sizes. And one distinguishing thing about conservatory libraries in Europe is a lot of them have important primary materials, whereas in the U.S. conservatories don't generally have a lot of primary materials. So anyway, I think you'll be surprised at some of what she has.
Thank you very much, Ilya, for this invitation. This is very important to me. And actually, what we have is the result of our history. This is the main difference, I suppose.
Yeah, and we should have a slide presentation.
Yes, it's here.
Oh, okay.
And so I'm the conservatory librarian in Florence, and this is the fourth year I work there. And I arrived, when I arrived, the meeting room was just reopened in 2010, because in 1966 there was a flood. So 40 years ago. This is not the result of practical difficulty. This is mental difficulty of people working there. What to do with all this important stuff? And we need money to buy pianos and make concerts and so on. So this is library. It is too expensive, perhaps. Well, and so there are difficulties which are completely different from what we have seen by now, and I'll try to explain. So I've been involved in copyright, and as Ilya said, and that was an opportunity that gave me the idea that we should always think that what we see every day is just a very, very little piece of the world, and we should think that it is all related to us and not to everybody, because there is a comment I can make later on. And so Italian conservatories are now in a very strange moment because we changed. There was a reform in 1999, so research became an important issue for conservatories, which until now they only did education and production, not in place, but now they are compelled to make research. So now the question is, what is research for a musician? It is not musicology, it's not analysis, but it is for composers. And there is a big issue now in Europe, and I suppose also here, about the concept of artistic research. It is artistic research, the research that players can do, which is very similar to what librarians can do, because we are practice, and how to make practice, research on practice. So, Ilya asked me, what obstacles to you does a digital or even digital edition pose in a conservatory library? And I reformulate this, what obstacle does a conservatory library pose to use a digital or even a critical edition? Because this is the way I handle the problem, my everyday life. There are lots of issues. You can't believe the difference between what we have seen before and what I'm telling now, but you can trust me that beyond Florence, there is a big part of the world, which is the Latin world, Spain, Portugal, Latin America, who share these kind of problems. So, administrative issues. I have to explain to the administrators what is something online you buy and you don't see. But just 2 days ago, my colleague is in Vicenza told me he took 2 years to explain this concept. And it took him 2 years to buy JSTOR. Okay? Because nobody wants to put this sign under the phone. Okay? This is a great responsibility to sign something you don't see. Okay? So 2 years. So another friend of mine told me that these kind of problems were in the US here something like 20 years ago. And we experience now 30 years later. So there is this differences in time, not only geographical distance, but also this difference in time. So, which are the issue of organizational, technical issues? Do I have the right equipment in my library? If I have a CampusNet, of course, an online thing is very well to me, but if I have perhaps the net just only in the library, or even I have one standalone computer, what do I need to be online? And how does it cost me? And how many people can use a digital thing if I have only one computer? If I have a net, the whole institution has that. But if I don't have, I can serve only 2-3 people. So paper is much better for them, perhaps. And when is this music available? If it's on the net, always 24 hours. And if I have it on the library must be open. But if I don't have the staff to open the library. So you see, on one side you see that if things are going on, it's perfect because everything is, you can do everything, everybody can do it always. And on the other side, you can do practically nothing. So we have then some issue that I wrote down, paper issues, which is the restriction that the library imposes, library rules when you have an edition. A restriction on reading, I've just said, it depends. If the library is closed, you don't. Restriction on loan, critical editions and periodicals are not available for loans. And on reproductions, which are, which is the third important service of the library, we have in Europe, I don't know how many people know here, the specific rules for critical editions that may help the use because they are shorter than normal copyright. Normal copyright is 17 years, okay, after the death of the author, but the critical edition became on public domain 25 years after the first publication, which is a completely different thing. That means that lots of Rossini volumes are on public domain, okay? Of the first edition. not the new one, but the rerouter. So this is the legal issue. We have really two different, the world is really divided in two. Part of the world who has the copyright laws is a legal environment. And the part of the world who has another legal environment, which is called diritto d'autore in Italiano, or droit d'auteur in French, or Rechtsgesetz in German, are similar and are completely different. You can't simply compare. They are different rules and they need to arrive to the same service, but they start from different points. So the issue in general, legal issue, depends on the balance among publisher, libraries, scholars, and user, which exists in each society. So what is balanced? We made an international survey on copyright from 2004 to 2008 with the YAM Association, and you find it on the YAM website. We asked something like 20 questions to all librarians about library service and copyright. And what came out was that for the same point, different people in different countries had this completely different feeling. For example, if in North Europe people are very happy to pay for loan and they think that that is good, in Latin world they think that as loan was always without paying, it's horrible if we are compared to paying for loan. So legal issues is related to the society, not to the objects, are related to the people. What kind of license restrictions is, was the question of the MLA. What kind of license restrictions, probably I can give it here, are we agreeing when we buy these editions? It was the question on the. And are they legally binding if we actually don't sign anything? I suppose that this is really the wrong way to pose a question. So you can't change agreements, you can't change the rules, not recognize the rules, because your rules have the same equal value to the rules of other people. So if you don't like an agreement, you say, I don't like it. But you don't say, is this legal? Because you go beyond anything. And you say, I wanted to ask you, to for example, are you satisfied of the costs of online things? Because as far as I know, in Italy, because I can talk about Italy and I'm working on this, all online bibliographical databases are completely unaffordable of prices and no library has them. So I've studied with RIM, with RIP, with all these things, and with RISM we still can study because it's free. What about the young scholars now? They won't see RIM ever because it's unaffordable. So same solution for so different societies? Or should we talk about something to do with that? Because do we want really that entire countries are completely out of research? Because this is what is happening. And then there is the one I like very much, a shared, as many people know here, a shared issue is preservation. Who is in charge of preserving the cultural heritage? In the original form or in paper, on digital format, as audio file, CD and video, we are talking about cultural heritage. This is the website of the Italian network, Nazionale Network Internet Culturale, which is going to Europeana. And thanks to Laurent Pogène, we have here, we try to make an agreement with Reason to have some adjustment for the printed version of Reason. This is Arcadelt, Jacob Arcadelt, Primo Libro di Madrigali a Quattro Voci. It's in my library. And this is the unique piece we have of this source. It's the unique source in all the world. And now it is online for free because this is the politics of the Italian nation. And my question is, what sources are online? Who is interested in the relationship between the source and the library where it is preserved? It is an ethic issue. Is it interest to scholars anymore? They are not more users because they use the online. Publishers, online projects, end users? Or are librarians completely alone with this problem? The owner is the one who should take care of the original. And if it's raining and the roof has a hole, it's my problem, it's not yours. Because of course it's not raining on your head. But actually the source is... So I suppose that cultural heritage is really something that is something we should take care of in the world and find other models to be active in this sense really, because there is a little question. We need simply money to do that. And it's very cost expensive. So, what happened? At some point this year, it happened to me that I had to go to the library because the fireman said that the library was out of rules, so we couldn't have books there. And so I reacted in this way. I made an exhibition in the library of the sources. And as there were people asking me to read in some quartets, I invited them to just to play the sources in the library. So. This is some images of the library that this was around December with some old books on the empty shelves. And if you see the red one on the right, these are the quartets that they were written for a competition that Abramo Baseli, which is the man you don't see very well, is the bust there, the founder of the conservatory. And this is the Quartetto Fonerini in quartets who won the Baseli competition in 1962-1965. This is because next year will be a celebration, so the quartet needs to choose the repertoire for their concerts. And just using the parts that some pupil at the end of the 19th century made from the autograph, it was completely okay. It was really astonishing because they started from the first note and they didn't stop until the end, the first sight. And there was only one of this quarter they couldn't read because at some point it becomes really a mess and because of accidents doesn't work. So one of them go back to the autograph, check what was not going on, and then they could start again. So we go back to our oral critical edition done by the music people themselves. Okay, that is how we can go around the problem.
Thank you very much, Federica. I think you get a whiff of some other larger issues, and I'm actually glad that the last two talks touched on copyright, the handling of copyright, and some issues related to that. I'd like to have the panel reconvene up here so we have everybody here for our discussion. But while that's happening, I'd like to ask the projectionist actually to turn off this thing. So people in our audience also talk about online issues that have some relationship in the eyes of the relationship. So first of all, Marnix. Marnix Van Berken.
Thank you. I don't know. I'm Marnix Van Berken. I'm an affiliate researcher at Utrecht University. Associate Director of the CDA project, and I'm also working at a large data archive in the Netherlands storing research data of social science and humanities. We'll start briefly talk about the CDA project. I think one of the things we really, well, our principle is that we should take away as many barriers as possible for using addition but also using data. I think we should make a distinction between publications and the underlying data. I don't want to make a big point now of publishers moving to the open access model. That's perhaps more on the publication, but I think we should really say, well, for the musicological community, it's also important to have the underlying data, to have the MBI, the music XML, whatever format you use, have it available next to your edition, have it open. So take away as many barriers as possible. So it's access, it's reusability. Well, if you talk about the USB stick in the backside of a book, I mean, it's difficult if you have to get to the physical object. That's one barrier. Online, of course, you have software requirements, etc. So the point I want to make is that it's very important what we did in the CDME is take away as many barriers as possible, and would really invite the audience also to think about it that in that way.
Thank you very much, Marnix. And Richard Friedman.
I'm Richard Friedman from Haverford College, and I've been involved for the last several years in the Digital Duchemin project with my partners at the Center for Renaissance Studies in Tours, and we have, through that project, a series of facsimiles of original sources engraved in PDF format, modern editions for performers to use, and also a resource that uses MEI to deliver dynamic editions online. And the facsimiles, the PDFs, and also the underlying encoding and the tools, because these all have been produced with public research grants from the NEH and from the CNRS and other agencies, are all considered public goods. So they're all available on a Creative Commons license, and as long as you don't sell them, you can do anything you want with them. So we are in favor of making all of those things available. I can completely appreciate why others would be in a different situation, investing with non-public resources and need to recoup those and otherwise make those things work. But you can hear about some of the tools that we have in the poster session this afternoon and in a pair of presentations tomorrow. So I support what Marnix was saying, and I'm quite interested to hear how these models might develop.
Thank you very much, Richard. Now I would like to get into the discussion, and our speakers have been very conscientious about sticking to time limits, and for that reason I think we can have a really fruitful discussion. But I would like, first of all, to give the panelists a chance to ask their own questions on each other. Would anybody on the panel like to pose a question?
My question is, it's true, a question.
The question to me was, do I like paying fees? No, I think they're outrageous, to be honest. And I doubly hate it because we're such a large school. Most of these license fees are based on your enrollment or the numbers of people that, so we always pay the highest. So if someone in a small school is paying hundreds and we're paying thousands of dollars. But I will say we're in a good situation because it's part of a large university library system. Our colleagues in the sciences are paying on a scale of I don't know how many more for similar types of database access. So, you know, when we complain about something costing $2,000 as a license fee to access it this year, they're saying, you know, we're paying $20,000 to $30,000 to $40,000 for some of our databases. So we don't want too much. But so I think in that case, music is very lucky. However, in a situation like yours where you may not have a science librarian with a very expensive database or I can see where that can be very difficult. And we just happen to be very fortunate that we have the resources to do it. But that is changing. I mean, occasionally we're asked to make cuts, and you know, music cuts are not as dramatic as, say, the sciences, for example.
An interesting example of the thing that comes to my mind is consortial purchasing. And I think one approach may be to look at how Italian libraries might pool resources to create universal access. You know? So none of your vendors will take some money over no money. So if you can say none of us will ever subscribe on our own, but if we can give you X amount of dollars, whatever you can come up with, and provide us access, that's, you know, for 20 institutions, it's, you know, $10,000 you didn't have before. They may say yes. And, you know, another, like, a flip side to that is the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Is that the, where it's sort of community finances, you know, grassroots funding, basically. And that, I wonder if that's not a useful model for these critical editions and how the sort of, you know, we want the content available because we, rather small community, place a high value on the knowledge that a good edition contains. But we, you know, behind the open source model is a lot of institutions that are providing a lot of resources to make these things available. And, you know, I think that these other sort of funding models are ones that need to be considered if the goal is to provide universal access.
Other comments on those points? I can't tell you one single thing about the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, is that what it's called? My belief is, my instinctive recollection, but possibly not very accurate, is that that was an experiment in collaborative authorship back in the beginning, and it goes back maybe to the late 90s. I mean, it's been around for quite a while. I never hear it mentioned these days, to tell you the truth, but I can probably find out. Douglas, you look quizzical.
No?
Okay. Norbert?
I'd like to ask, then he explained a little bit of process that could go on at the Library of Congress if somebody requests to reproduce pictures. Now, if I'm not wrong, you mentioned the criterion, commercial or non-commercial. In our case, offer is done by a project that is financed, receives public financing and is non-commercial, while the product in the end is sold by BMI. How would you judge this?
Well, it's my hope that we'll have a separate agreement with Baron-Rider for facsimile edition. I don't want to have to pay for it. yeah, I don't, that isn't easily sorted out. But I do believe strongly, I mean, the editions, and Phil was saying this too, the opera edition and most editions produced by Baron-Rider are beautiful. They're fabulously done. The editorial work is of the highest quality. That's something that has value and is not going to happen if no one pays for it. So it's a really thorny situation. It's a dilemma that's compounded by scenarios like the one Frederica describes, where these expensive editions are entirely unavailable in many places. So I wish I had an answer.
Well, there isn't one. I mean, if you have a situation where a publisher like Baron-Rider is not capable of producing these editions, then who's going to produce them?
Such as?
produce these editions if we're not doing them? I mean, these things are being critical editions mostly, these complete, these monumental editions are being paid for with state money, whether it's in Germany or whether it's in France or in England or someplace else. We then get these manuscripts delivered to the publisher from these institutes, and we are then responsible for having these editions engraved. We then work together with the institutes, having these things read, corrections, consultations, modifications, and then we run the risk by spending this money on these editions to produce them and disseminate them. And the risk is then ours, because the institute doesn't have any risk, its money is being spent, paid for by the state. If we're not doing this, then these institutes that are doing the research for an edition will have to produce the editions themselves. And then they'll have to be their own vehicle for disseminating these editions. And I'm not sure that that's an aspect of commerce that they can just sort of ad hoc take on.
I think that's a very fair point. And I think there's a larger discussion that, you know, those in library circles have been hearing about a lot, with open repositories for the periodical literature that we all pay a lot for and complain a lot about the cost of those as well. There isn't an easy answer. If there were, we wouldn't be having a conversation. However, I think, you know, the point that I was making, if the researcher was able to, is it necessary to publish that print thing? Currently, I think, you know, the data that I showed said, yeah, probably. But if it were available exclusively online, would the cost be different? Is that a model that will evolve over time? I don't know if that is the case or not. You know, when you ask the question about who bears the cost, who owns that thing now that you put it online freely for the world, well, is the original still, does it still matter? I guess is the question. Is this artifact of that published thing, if I have a complete electronic edition of it in my library and his library and in your library, does the original matter anymore?
Well, the original is obviously something that is unique, and so it has an intrinsic value.
Agreed. Cool.
But I think we should come back to this thing, since all of the discussion has been about this this flash drive. It's quite obvious that I think when you look at this long list of operas being produced in the series, you'll see that that's not something that's going to be done in the next 5 years. We're talking about a good 10-year plan easily,
15.
Or 15 or longer. So if you sort of look back 15 years, we were dealing with a floppy disk and various other ways of transporting information. So it's quite possible in 15 years this flash drive is just not going to be usable in any form. It was not our intention, and has never been our desire, to have to produce something like this. But you can't forget that these manuscripts are owned by libraries, and libraries have, whether they're large ones, open libraries like the Library of Congress, or very small provincial libraries that own manuscripts, that they have fears, they have anxiety attacks about people wanting to look at their manuscripts, whether you can even come in with a camera without taking a flash, whether they can, you can even make a copy of something. By and large, a vast number of very important libraries that own sources, original sources, will not let you put them online categorically. If you took not a Salieri, which only has a couple of sources in some libraries, if you take a composer as a Bach or a Mozart that are disseminated around the world, just trying to get all of the rights for these things, to put them online so that everyone can have access to them, it's a major legal undertaking. And many libraries will not let you have it. I have just finished an edition of Debussy's Le Maire, where I have six autograph sources that I can't even name the owners of the sources in the edition. They're held privately in family collections. I can't name their names, and I can't have any facsimiles of these pages. It's a very spooky type of way to do an edition. I am having a critical report that no one can ever really compare the sources to see how I got to this reading here, and the chances of me ever having any of these sources complete in a digital form that somebody could look at is ridiculous. So it has to do with the ownership of something, whether I'm dealing with the Paul Sacher Stiftung in Basel in Switzerland, or I'm dealing with the Morgan Library in New York in the Lehman Collection, or I'm dealing with the University of Texas in the Carlton Lake Collection, and there are dozens more of them. You just cannot get complete access to these. And obviously that would be the best world. We would have a score where a conductor, in this case, could put on a performance and parts extracted from it, and a vocal score, so that somebody could perform a work, or a performers could put on a Ravel string quartet. And at the same time, we have a critical commentary and all of the sources available online so that anybody could use it. You'd have both worlds like this. But at the moment, it doesn't seem possible.
Thank you very much. Yeah,
I want to say something. Is that I think with this opera project, it should have almost been at the very beginning to contact all the libraries, the major libraries that own these sources, and to contact all the major libraries that own these sources, and to use that leverage to deal with smaller libraries to get them on board, because it's a question of like having a snowball effect. When libraries see that the Library of Congress is willing to be on to go on board and to allow you to put sources online, then other smaller libraries will stop having daily anxiety attacks.
May I ask a question for this?
Yes. Let's let Norbert talk to that.
We had this case already, and I used the generosity of the Austrian National Library as a leverage for the conservatory in Pesaro. I said they gave us the permission for free, and we hope to get it from you as well. But I want to mention one other case, and for my edition of Paez Leonora, I need a score that is in the library of the Lobkowitz family. Yeah. And this is a huge, it's not a small private collection, no. It's enormous. And nobody has access, and nobody can do
it. You have to know where all the bodies are buried.
So I'm wondering, what if you just rethink this system that you already have in place, where you sort of get licensing for the images, not for public use, but just to be delivered on the flash drive, and instead of putting on hardware that you know is going to be obsolete, what if you switch those costs to maintaining an online edition with your own means, and you will control access to that through a paywall, for example? It's a matter of sort of switching investment from creating the physical discs to maintain a service online that then the libraries can subscribe to. Obviously, there's a difference in costs from going to something that you create and then you can forget about it to something that you have to maintain for a very long time, but it's a solution that doesn't require having to go to all the libraries and you still keep the same sort of market solutions that you have now.
Well, in this case, the libraries only allowed us to produce enough, the number of flash drives equal to the number of printed volumes. So the question of, in this specific case, was not a question of us being able to even for a moment consider putting it online. They wouldn't even allow us to sell the volumes to a library and then allow them to on their internet.
Right, but I thought the problem of putting on the internet was a matter of access. So if you're making it available to everyone, then you have a problem. But if you have a paywall, that it's only access is only granted to either subscribers or who already purchased the book, then you're not putting it online.
No, I understand, but it's a question of negotiations. It's not every library, they don't all tick the same way. I have situations where I have a library in southern Italy where I've waited 2 years for photocopies for 14 pages because they don't have anybody that has a camera that works in the library. So a discussion about using that source in another form like that is just totally out of the question.
Right. I think one thing that's coming to light is there are an awful lot of potential obstacles to what we're focused on. And there are an awful lot of explanations, and common explanations are really hard to come by. I did want to highlight one issue that Federica brought up because it's popped up in my life over and over again in all sorts of different contexts, and it's something where there is a little bit of misunderstanding between the U.S. and probably Canada vis-a-vis Europe and most of the rest of the world, as far as I can make out, which has to do with cultural property. As far as I understand it, cultural property in Europe, by and large, has its own sort of authority and protection that's separate from copyright. We tend to roll everything into copyright in the US, or we understand it that way. But in many other parts of the world, cultural property is a primary thing, and copyright is something that lawyers invented about 100 years ago, a little longer in the UK. And actually, there was a question this morning about, I think it was Seminole music. And we know from our own experience at CCARH with ThemeFinder, that in fact, specifically the Densmore, one of the constituent collections, the first Densmore that was put online by Paul von Hippel, that it turned out that the tribe, such as it is today, had an objection to that being on the internet because it is their cultural property. It's part of their definition of who they are. And as far as they're concerned, they are the only people who have the authority to say, you can use this. And we just turned up a very similar situation with what may very well be one of the underlying Chinese folk music collections that captured in the Essen database with a visiting Chinese music librarian at Stanford. And she has told me about a particular collection in her library in Shanghai, where in her terminology, and her English is a little bit rough, that it's been published, but it's not printed. And I think that means it's all carefully archived and put in the drawer, which is where it's intended to stay, for the consultation of people who are culturally appropriate individuals for accessing it. And some of this European manuscript stuff strikes me as not being too different from that.
Well, it's ownership.
Yeah.
It's 9/10 of the law. If a private person owns something, you have to ask for permission to look at it. It's just like anything else. It's just a matter of ownership. It's not a copyright thing.
No, it isn't a copyright thing, but here in the US we tend to think of it as incidental to copyright, and I think other places copyright is incidental to cultural property, and that difference is really important to keep in the back of your mind.
Yeah, I mean, when you order something from the Carlton Lakes collection in Texas, you have eight pages of form that you have to fill out. That's just owned by the state. That's not even a private collection.
Texas is a hard state to do.
Well, I mean, it's almost no matter where you look, there's always an exception. The exceptions are making the rule here.
Yeah, Mallory has a question.
Oh, I was just going to say that cultural property discussion is very much not a question of ownership. It's very much beyond that when you're involved in it. Depending on your lens that you look at it, you don't. It's not about ownership or buying. It's about cultural identity. So I think that we think it's about ownership in the U.S., but it's not about ownership even in the U.S., I can tell you. So it's the rights of a culture to make the decisions about its portrayal.
But I think in Europe, the taxpayers are in some instances, the culture. Because there are all these nationally funded, federally funded projects, state funded projects. In the US, we don't have that sort of funding. We have a little bit of it, but we don't have a lot of it. Canada has more than we do.
Yeah.
Richard?
Well, it's the difference between copyright and the rights of the author, right? If I happen to own a Picasso, I could burn it here in the United States. And that would be my right. But in Europe, it would be kind of stupid. I could deform the thing in some way, but that is not a right that the owner has under European law, at least under the rights of the author, who can control the ways in which the material is disseminated. And I think that's the basic difference between, as someone suggested before, copyright and the droit d'auteur system. And I think that's part of the problem, that maybe extends to the notion of a patrimony as well. I'm not a copyright attorney, but I think that's part of the mentality that we're here.
Yeah, and another difference between library holdings and rare materials in the U.S. and in Europe is, in Europe, the source is very often close to the point of origin of the material. So let's say the Bach Archive in Leipzig holds materials that may never have left Leipzig, for all I know. Whereas Italian 18th century manuscripts in the Library of Congress probably crossed the Atlantic at some point. So there's a little bit of a physical disconnect.
I think the stuff is pretty well disseminated around the globe. I don't think you can really say that anymore. Vast majority of early 19th century French music is in the States. You have complete collections of Rachmaninoff in the Library of Congress and Bartok. I mean, they have nothing to do with it at all.
Were there questions over here? I haven't been looking this way very much.
I have a question for...
Okay, now?
I'm wondering if, because I haven't yet seen the first, can you hear? Oh, sorry. The first volume of opera, I really look forward to it. Is your intention to actually have in this magic calligraphy all the facsimile of all the sources? Because what I wonder is, for example, for the Marezzo, we had a discussion, so how much to put online in terms of facsimiles, and also because it's so difficult, as you rightly pointed out. We decided, no, we don't want to do it. We want to preserve the role of the editor, in a sense. And I wonder if in today's world where it seems easy to have all these images, we have a little bit of we have something to learn from the old printed paper editions in which there was only one or two pages at the beginning, and you could ask another library just to give the permission to photograph that. There was no issue of presenting the whole, as if the editor had needs to be edited and tested again. In a sense, we renounced to a mission of run the risk of, we have a role as editors of mediating, whether we want it or not. But what is the position? Was there a discussion, I wonder, about this, given in for the opera, about how many facsimiles, all of them?
No, it is very clear. It is an edition. It is not a collection of digital images, and you will find, you will find a list of sources, and a source evaluation, and only these sources that are important for this particular edition are also included as facsimile if they are available. Yeah. So you may find 20 copies of Bimala Musica, but only four scores are really important. You could even say there's the autograph score, there's an authorized copy, or two, and there's one, this Pesaro score that is a little bit mysterious. So there are four scores and some additional material, and the rest, I mean, there's the Sarti Giulio Sabino, where Salieri took the pieces from. But in this case, from the whole Giulio Sabino score, only three pieces are reproduced in facsimile, not the rest. As I said, there is no bonus. Only the sources that are really important, and there's every edition includes a source evaluation that tells you the relationship between the sources.
Are there visual sources like from the premiere, or is it really about music and text?
It is music and text.
Okay.
There's one, we discussed whether to include one engraving of a scene from Giulio Savino, and we decided to just put a link because the picture is available online on the website of the Austrian National Library, so you don't need it.
One thing I noticed in performance, because I taught in a Savoy School of Music, I'm a story group, as a huge DMA program, is that performers like to have, or also in order to write good papers, all these paratextual materials, and sometimes it's better than having five editions of the same piece, but having instead all the visual, maybe also musicologists writing about the piece, and that makes the edition actually more really live for them. Because in the end, they are those who perform, study, or... Thank you very much.
I'd like to close this session with one remark of my own, which only relates to a small point, except that the two are obstacles. It's a big point that somebody made about libraries that no longer have photographic services available. I do a lot of work in the Venetian State Archives, and I was publishing a book 5 years ago for which I really wanted to have some reproductions of certain documents. And it was just after they had gotten rid of their photographic staff and a budgetary cutback. And I was invited to take my own pictures with my digital camera. But in order to do that, I had to do what you always had to do, go out to the tobacconist and get a tobacconist stamp authorizing me to take pictures in the state-funded library. And I took my images and I edited my images and I prepared them with my book for the publisher. The publisher was in the US. And then I was told by the archives that I couldn't publish my own images because there was a state law that had been adopted approximately 25 years ago that you had to have a contract with the library that held the images. And the next time I was in Venice, I signed a 9-page typescript contract citing the protocol law with the person designated in the archives, the official bureaucrat in charge of signing contracts for the use of one's own digital images as material. And it was sealed with sealing wax and a string. So the pages can never be separated. And when I told my publisher, and this contract states en route that if the resulting, they're giving you permission to use your own photographs, but if the resulting book costs more than 77.4 euros, if I remember correctly, then the contract was null and void and you had to go back and get a new contract. My publisher didn't know what to do with that at all.
I suppose that you catch the point. The problems, the behaviors in libraries in Europe are too different. We need what we can't have because we have laws about copyright things, but we need tables to discuss how to write a contract, what is needed, how much do I earn if I give you the images and how much is important. Because we need really to be more practical. The problem is that in Europe, as you said, the public, what is in public libraries is of public use. So there is this idea that what is in public use, nobody can earn on it. So this is a problem. But of course, then to keep this, to preserve this public heritage, it costs. So we should go out from this mentality. And if we want to have everything online, as the Conservatory of San Pietro Maiella did, because the state paid for images, and there are hundreds of autographs now online for free. And who is taking care of the autographs now? So you can do that way. The state can do this to the libraries. Okay? So you can make your policy on the head of your libraries. You should involve them and with publishers and with the editors and find an agreement. Possibly each case is different, but we need agreements and share also not only the problems but also actually the money that can come from an initiative, which is economic initiative.
Thank you very much. We're going to close this panel, but we continue informally with our break. And after that, the posters. So there should be plenty of time for product exchanges. And I hope the ideas will come.
But if you have